welcome to a brand new episode of Doctor Who Panel to Panel. This is Jeremy B. Bench, your host, saying hello, happy March, and I hope everybody's having a really good year so far. I know I am. And here is a rundown of what we have in store on this episode of Doctor Who Panel to Panel. We're going to start out like we always do by checking out the news, find out what is new in the world of Doctor Who comics. And then we're going to go through some reviews. We're going to start off with the most recent comic strip that has come out, which is Part 3 of Mancopolis. That is the new part that came out in Doctor Who Magazine number 601. After that, we're going to take a look at a couple spin-off comics. The first thing we're going to take a look at is the comic series Miranda. It was a three-issue comic series that came out back in 2003 by writer Lance Parkin. It features a character that he created for the Doctor Who BBC novel Father Time. And we're going to take a look at that, kind of how the series came about and kind of the history about it. We'll also take a look at the issues and I'll do my review of them. And then one final review, we're going to take a look at a Torchwood comic story. It was a one-issue story called Jetsam. It was in Torchwood magazine, issue number 3, and we're going to take a look at that since we're kind of featuring spinoffs this time around. And then the main feature of this episode, I have an interview with writer Ian Winterton. He is one of the main writers for Cutaway Comics, which is kind of the main spinoff comic company that's out there. They've done a lot of series. They've done Paradise Towers, they've done Litton, they've done Omega. They have a new series starting up here pretty soon called Gods and Monsters. They're also doing a series based on the Doctor Who comic, or a classic story, Inferno. So I had a really wonderful chat with Ian Winterton. I will say that in the recording, you'll notice that my side of the audio sounds nowhere near as good as Ian's. There was something going on with Zoom at the time, and I'm rather quiet. However, you are able to hear me. Ian definitely stands out much more, and which he's the most important part to hear. So you'll learn a lot about Ian, how he got into writing, and how he got into working with Cutaway Comics, and much more there. And that's pretty much this episode in a nutshell. So thank you for downloading this episode. I hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. Thank you for supporting this podcast. Make sure you check out my website, DoctorWhoComics.com. And let's jump into this episode and take a look at the news. In Doctor Who comic news for this episode of Panel to Panel, let's take a look at the calendar. As far as Doctor Who comics go, it's rather quiet. There's nothing new from Titan Comics outside of Free Comic Book Day coming up the first Saturday in May, where we'll get a peek at a 15th Doctor comic from them. But outside of that, on Thursday, the 29th, leap day of February, Doctor Who Magazine issue number 601 came out, which we're going to review the comic strip from there here shortly. So if you get your comic or your Doctor Who Magazine over in the UK or digitally, you got the new issue then. And according to my calculations then, Doctor Who Magazine number 602 should come out on Thursday, March 28th. So make sure you're on the lookout for that. That's kind of it for the calendar. The only other Doctor Who comic-related news I could find is that there was an announcement that a new collection from Panini called The Return of the Daleks, the Complete Doctor Who Backup Tales Volume 1 trade paperback, is now on the calendar and is scheduled for release over in the UK on July 1st. This is going to start reprinting a lot of the backup strips, or working on getting those backup strips reprinted and out there. It looks like this trade is going to kind of fall in line with the Fourth Doctor anthology that they're doing now, as well as those two Dalek volumes and the Cybermen volume, kind of more into that motif. So I'm almost wondering if, now that the other books are kind of going out of print or have been out of print for a while, if they're going to start reprinting those in this new format, this new look, which, if that's the case, more power to them. Sell more books, get more Doctor Who comics out into fans' hands. I am all in favor of that. I should also mention that the 13th Doctor collection, The White Dragon, just came out over in the UK, or is about to come out over in the UK. So make sure you're on the lookout for that. There's some really good stories in that book. And I guess that's it in way of Doctor Who comic news. Let's go into some reviews. It's time to open the Bandorica on a new Doctor Who comic strip, and this time around we are taking a look at Mancopolis Part 3. This is in the new issue of Doctor Who magazine, issue number 601. The story continues to be written by Alan Barnes, with art by Lee Sullivan, coloring by James O'Fredy, lettering by Roger Langridge, and Marcus Hearn is the editor. And the story continues on, or the strip continues on, from where we left off last time, which the Doctor and Ruby Sunday have been attacked by these black things with fangs out to attack them. And the Doctor uses the sonic screwdriver to create a sonic pulse and kind of stalls them while they're able to run away and escape. Ruby recognizes where they're at and leads them out to Old Manchester. And that's when they are kind of wandering around and they see the moth creatures that are coming to get after them. The moth creatures say that, or radio back or relay a message back to the moth mother saying that they're going to lose the Doctor and Ruby because they're heading towards the night town or the kind of the music district, which the moth mother says, "I'm busy, you know, go after them, send in the care force." She has a meeting with the auditors. So the Doctor and Ruby discover that they're in, or they find a bunch of people. They find the music district or the party district, and the Doctor wants to find somebody who can help them get back to Mancopolis. While they're kind of doing that, there's somebody who sees Ruby, but then the Care Force start coming down, trying to track them down. And this person says, "The Care Force is going to get you. Here, I have this bracelet that will help you." Ruby was like, "No, I told you I don't want it. Nope, no thanks." Well, this person turns into a moth creature and snaps the bracelet on Ruby, and Ruby gets teleported away. The Doctor's like, "Ruby, where'd you go?" And then we kind of have a two-handed part going on where Ruby is thinking about dancing, and it turns out she is in a cocoon. And the moth mother is having a meeting with the auditors while she tells them that we are the Lepidopterans, or the moth people, and we have created this new fabric that called Manco polyester. But in order to do that, they are using the bones and organs of people to create it. And that's kind of where the cliffhanger is for this strip or this storyline. I thought this is a good part of the story to move things forward. We get to the, here's what these creatures are, here's what they're trying to do. And of course, this is what the Doctor is going to have to stop. I thought Alan Barnes is telling a really good story. I appreciate how he took something like moths or you know, the insects like that and kind of coming up with a sci-fi story using them as the aliens. The Lepidopterans is a really good name, I think. And Lee Sullivan's artwork, of course, is really good. It services the story perfectly. It's a good flow. Everything, it reads along really nicely. And I really enjoyed this part. I think you will as well, if you've been reading Mancopolis. It's been a good first adventure for the Doctor and Ruby, I think. And I give it 2 thumbs up. So make sure you check it out in the new issue of Doctor Magazine, Doctor Who Magazine number 601. Exterminate! Miranda was a character created by writer Lance Parkin, and she first appeared in the Doctor Who novel Father Time. It was an Eighth Doctor novel written by Lance Parkin that introduced her as a kind of the daughter of the Doctor. She was a girl who was adopted by the Eighth Doctor, and the Father Time novel I read on a flight out to California for one of the Gallifrey One conventions, and it was a really good novel. I really enjoyed it. I read it pretty much all in one sitting on the flight out there. And I was really overjoyed when I had found out that Lance Parkin was going to do a comic book miniseries of Miranda in 2003. Now, this was way before the days of Kickstarter or Indiegogo or Zoop or any of those fundraising ventures where you could pitch something to an audience and raise money and get the money ahead of time, really, for a book. So Lance was somebody who was kind of ahead of the game on this. he came up with not really a fundraising campaign, but basically said, I'm going to come up with a five-issue miniseries of Miranda, tell a story about her, and you can subscribe to it and get the issues as they're released. And I don't even remember how I had heard about it. It popped up somehow on my Doctor Who radar. And so I subscribed to this comic series. Now, unfortunately, he was only able to put out three issues of this comic series, but it was pretty entertaining, and it's probably the earliest version of a Doctor Who comic spinoff that is out there. So I thought I'd do a review of the series and talk a little bit about it. So, like I said, it was a miniseries that was ahead of the game as far as like Kickstarter or anything like that. But it was written by writer Lance Parkin. The art was by Alan Bednar with Robert Blancas. And then the third issue was by Miguel Montenegro and John Taylor. And unfortunately, the fourth and fifth issues never came out just because Lance wasn't making enough money on this venture to make it financially viable to come out with the finale of the series. But it's really hard to find these issues. They're really tough to come by, but I thought I would give you some plot synopses of these issues just so you can kind of get a gist of what the character is and what the story was about. So thanks to the interwebs, here is plot synopsis for the first issue. Miranda, who thought herself to be an ordinary British teenager of the 1980s, has been abducted by beings from the far distant future and told that she is in fact the long-lost heir of the notorious Imperial family. Following a universal cataclysm, the race which caused the disaster came to rule over the chaos. Miranda's real father was assassinated when she was a baby, but Imperial sympathizers hid her in the past while the Empire collapsed into 1,000 warring factions, all struggling for power. Now, Prefect Farron, the leader of one such faction, has found Miranda and the Supremacy, a ship capable of traveling anywhere in time and space, transports her billions of years into the future to take her rightful place as Empress and unite the warring factions. In order to do so, however, she will have to survive numerous assassination attempts from individual parties with their own varied agendas. She has a vast army at her disposal, or rather, at Farron's, and her new home will be the Needle, an artificial structure 1 light-year in length. Already overwhelmed, Miranda soon has something else to worry about, as her maidservant slips her a note warning her that Farron intends to kill her. So that's what we find out in the first issue. Moving on to issue 2, Farron escorts Miranda to a reception at which she meets and mingles with representatives of the factions which she is expected to unite. She is also reunited with the maid who slipped her the warning note, but the maid refuses to discuss the matter in public and promises to explain all later. However, Miranda is then attacked by a large flying assassin and plucked out of the reception. Her attacker kills one of the Sky Wardens sent to rescue her and drops Miranda in the process. However, Miranda seizes the Sky Warden's jetpack, and although she's unable to use it properly, it does cushion her fall. When Miranda inadvertently triggers it a second time, it jets straight into her attacker and explodes. Shaken, Miranda retreats to her quarters for a bath, and while she's there, the maid who slipped her the warning note, Kelly, explains that Farron intends to gain personal political power by forcing Miranda to marry him and then disposing of her. Unfortunately, Farron has circumvented Kelly's safeguards and is now aware of everything that she's just said to Miranda. And then we kind of get into the heart of the story with issue number 3. Kelly promises to find Miranda somewhere to hide, informing her that only 2% of the Needle's enormous structure has been mapped out. However, Farron hides freelancers Rum and Thalash to track her down, claiming that she's been kidnapped, and he sends his robot adjutant along with them to ensure that Miranda is returned directly to him. Meanwhile, Kelly takes Miranda to a forest on the surface of the Needle, where Miranda meets Kelly's brother, Mac Gideon, a hero to some, a traitor to others. Gideon explains that Farron wants Miranda as his bride because her genetic structure is the key to the Labyrinth, a storehouse containing all of the lost technology and knowledge of the universe. Farron's robot adjutant then catches Miranda and Gideon together, but Miranda takes Gideon's gun and shoots the robot before it can take her back to Farron. However, Rum and Thalash are right behind it, and they strike down Gideon before Miranda even knows they're there. And there you go. That's kind of where the series left off, or where it ended. Because, like I said, the funding just wasn't there at this point in time to finish this Miranda series. So, kind of my review of this series is, I thought the story was pretty good. It has a lot of, I guess, kind of tropes of other mythological, not really mythological tales, but kind of fairy tales about somebody who doesn't realize or doesn't know that they're a princess until they're told about it, and there's people trying to use her to gain power, and but this has kind of like that sci-fi aspect to it. I thought it was a fun story. I thought it was really interesting. As far as the art goes, Alan Bednar was the main artist on this. Montenegro was the one who did the art for the third issue. And I believe, talking to Alan, he doesn't have a lot of recollection of this story that he did, but I believe it was something that was done early on in his career. The covers that he did for the first couple issues I thought were really well done. However, the artwork that was inside, I think it had a lot to be desired. I could tell by looking at this, it looked like it was done by an artist who probably was an up-and-comer, and it was serviceable for the story, but I believe if this story was going to be represented in current times, I would personally hire a new artist and just have it totally redone. And speaking of if the story was going to be redone in present day, once I started doing some research on Miranda and talking about it, I came to discover that Cutaway Comics, who is somebody, it's a company who has been doing a lot of Doctor Who spinoff comics using properties, characters, and settings and stuff from Doctor Who, has reached out to Lance Parkin about the Miranda character and about this comic series in particular, and they are looking into redoing it. Or if nothing else, at least giving the series a conclusion. And as I was talking about this, writer Ian Winterton, who has done a lot of writing for Cutaway Comics, had been in touch with Gareth Cavanaugh, and this is what he had to say in regards to the Miranda series and Cutaway Comics possibly doing it.
Well, I can't say much, but I think I can say this. But yeah, so with Miranda, I know Gareth has been talking to Lance Parkin, and maybe it will come out as a cutaway production, I think. But it'd be absolutely brilliant to close the story, wouldn't it? But we'll have to check with Gareth. If you're hearing this, listener, then we've checked with Gareth and it's still okay for me to say this. But yeah, wouldn't that be brilliant?
So my final thoughts on the Miranda comic series is, first of all, I want to say that it was very admirable on Lance Parkin's side to be ahead of the game when it came to fundraising campaigns in order to put out a product. Like I said, he was ahead of the game of Kickstarter and Indiegogo in way of asking people to give him money for a comic series that he would put out. And he succeeded to that extent, at least for three issues out of the five-issue series he was planning on doing. I feel that being able to take a property that is yours or that you created and do something like this is very admirable, and I think he made a valiant effort to come up with something that fans of the character of Miranda would like. I personally thought the story was really good. The artwork, I think, was serviceable. I hope that Cutaway Comics does work out a deal with Lance and that they're able to redo this series and bring it into the fold of the Cutaway comic universe. And if that is the case, I still really love the character Miranda. I thought the character that was introduced in Father Time was very unique and very different. And I think that if this series comes out as a mini series, a comic series, that you should check it out and that it will you'll really enjoy it.
You will be deleted.
Jetsam was the title of a Torchwood comic strip that was written and drawn by Brian Williamson, with coloring by Chris Carter and lettering by Jimmy Bentoncorp of Comic Craft. And it was a strip, or a story that was in Torchwood magazine issue number 3 and was reprinted in the Torchwood trade paperback called Rift War. And it's kind of hard to find, but it's well worth finding if you have a chance. And we're going to take a look at it in the Into the Matrix segment, since we're doing spinoffs this time around. So let me give you a summary of this. This is thanks to the wonderful internet. A cargo ship outside of Cardiff Bay has several alien artifacts in its hold, which the crew were paid handsomely for transporting. When they first set off, the devices were dormant. However, when they got in range of the rift, one of the devices began to communicate to the crew using telepathy. It foretold tales of war and gave the taste of blood and metal. Spooked, the crew jettisoned the crates into the sea. The next morning, the crates have washed up on a beach, and Torchwood are among the first on the scene. They immediately start trying to quarantine the items and usher the public away. Tosh finds a giant motorcycle by one of the crates. In the sand next to it, however, are similarly sized tire tracks, indicating it was part of a pair. Surrounding the large tire tracks are several smaller motorcycle tracks. Gwen deduces that a group of Harley-Davidson motorcycles dragged the larger bike away, and that it was probably the work of a motorcycle gang. Jack orders Toshiko to start examining the remaining bike to try and figure out what they are up against, while he and Gwen investigate dive bars. After investigating several, they find a bar that was virtually destroyed and smoking. Upon getting closer, they find the bodies of all the members of the Brimstone Skulls apart from one, the leader, Drew Blaney. Suddenly, they hear a revving and the stolen motorcycle, piloted by Drew. He bursts from the debris of the bar and drives off, feeling no effect from the EMP gun Jack fires at it. Jack and Gwen chase the bike back towards the city in the Torchwood's SUV. Meanwhile, while investigating the other bike, Tosh discovers the bike operates on neural input. Suddenly, the input cables attach themselves to her, and she becomes possessed by the bike. The bike smashes through the wall and onto the streets of Cardiff. Tosh regains enough of her humanity to tell Owen and Yanto that the machine is drugging her and that it is automatically tracking down the other bike. Owen manages to download information directly from the bike and runs it through a translation device. It tells them that an unpronounceable alien race uses the bikes for duels to settle turf wars and border disputes. The bike would do most of the work with the occupant to provide tactics. Jack orders the authority to close a section of the motorway and orders Tosh to lure the other bike onto it. Yanto hires a helicopter for Jack so they can chase the bikes. Right by the Sunbury bypass, Jack shoots the EMP gun at Drew's bike, and during the brief time the weapon was effective, the bike crashes. Meanwhile, Owen encourages Tosh to find Mushin, a state of mental calmness that would have been featured in Tosh's childhood stories. When she finds it, she calms down and gets her own mind back. However, she still follows Drew and proceeds to start a self-destruct countdown, the resulting explosion from which would kill them both. Just before the countdown reaches zero, Drew's personality overpowers that of the bike and claims that he doesn't want to die. The bike takes this as a surrender, and Tosh is proclaimed the winner. As Tosh gets out of the bike, Drew sneaks up behind her with a knife. However, he is suddenly vaporized by one of the bikes for breaking the terms of the surrender. Tosh then orders both of the bikes to shut down and delete their core programming, putting them out of action for good. And there you go. There's the storyline for Jetsam. I thought this was a pretty good story. I thought Brian Williamson, his artwork is amazing. His artwork has always been amazing in whatever I've seen it in. And as far as the story goes, I felt the story was a little convoluted, kind of hard to follow. The synopsis I found gave a really good synopsis, really detailed as to what happened in the story, considering it was a rather short story. But there were lots of stuff that was in this synopsis that I did not find in the actual Jetsam story when I read it for myself. I felt there was a lot. I had to go through and reread it a second time to kind of figure out what was going on. And even still, stuff in the synopsis they found that I did not find on my second read. I don't know if maybe I just wasn't paying enough attention to it, or I believe it's more along the lines of you had to go through and really analyze the story panel by panel and do a bit of work in order to figure out what was going on in the story. So as far as artwork-wise, I thought it was excellent, but it didn't. The story had bits and pieces left out that I did not find in it. So I thought it was an okay story. It was kind of a nice little one-shot story for somebody like me who hasn't even done a lot of following a Torchwood or thought about Torchwood for quite some time. It was nice to go and visit a Torchwood story again and kind of refamiliarize myself with the characters of this main group of Torchwood. So that part I really enjoyed. However, I think I would have been better served by reading a story that actually kind of laid the story out a bit with a bit more clarity than what this one did. So good job, Brian William, on your artwork, but I felt you were lacking a bit on the story. And that is my review of Jetsam.
Hey, Ian, thank you for joining me on Doctor Who Panel to Panel today. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, and likewise. And you, as I was just saying, I've been listening to your pod for years. So
I appreciate that.
It's getting a bit surreal to be on it.
So how are things out in California, Gallifrey?
They were brilliant. It was my third time in a row going there. My third time going. As my new friend Paul Cornell telling us, it was his 25th. So people have been going for a long time. It really is the best con I've ever been to. But yeah, this year for myself and Gareth, it was extra special because we were sort of officially guests, so we were officially in the green room.
Awesome.
as well as the fact that meant we got free sandwiches and free cups and tea and coffee all day, every day, which was nice. We were also in the dealer's room selling our comics, but it also meant our day was broken up being on panels and things, which was fun and an honor. I mean, just an honor in general, but because it was a bit of a rush, I'd go onto a panel. And then it's only when we were talking, I realized I was sat next to David Gerald, who wrote Trouble for Tribbles. And all sorts of things. I was like, "Oh my god, I'm sat next to a legend." So it was. It was full of that sort of stuff. But yeah, but great fun and getting to meet the fans that way. And because I do lots of different things as well as the comics. I'm a university lecturer. I used to be a film journalist for 20 years. So especially horror movies and stuff. Sort of aside from Doctor Who. So I got to speak about horror and all manner of things like that on the panel. But yeah, just awesome. So I'd say I love every time we go to Gallifrey, but I'd say this year was my favorite, just because it wasn't just sitting selling comics and then drinking. It was sitting selling comics, running off and doing stuff, interesting stuff, and then going to the bar and then having lobby con. So it was because it was so varied. It was a good one.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and Derek Jacobi was there as well.
That's cool.
Who I've worked with before, so that was good to say hello to him. So that was all good.
Awesome. Yeah, you know, I don't know all that much about you as far as like what work you've done in the past. You mentioned a few things here. As far as like writing stuff, how did you get involved just in writing in general?
I guess I've always been doing it. I did a degree in it back in the early 90s. Okay. At weirdly the same place, I've told this story elsewhere, but at the same place Paul Cornell went. But I didn't meet him there because he just graduated. But when I went there, my lecturer said, "Oh, you like Doctor Who? Well, maybe you should try writing for these Virgin New Adventures," because one of our graduates, Paul Cornell, has just started writing for them and he's doing quite well. So I tried writing for Virgin New Adventures and got nowhere. But it was just a difficult time in the early 90s because I didn't have a computer. I wasn't in the place to sit down and write a novel. Being too young and not having my own computer and being too poor for even that, it just wasn't happening. But then weirdly, Paul Cornell came in to give a speech, give a little thing to the to the students as a former student. And weirdly, that morning I got my first ever acceptance letter from a magazine, which was Doctor Who magazine, and it was Gary Russell at the time was the editor. So I had
a letter
from some guy I'd never heard of called Gary Russell, and then some guy I'd only vaguely heard of. I went, I've just had this acceptance for a brief encounter in Doctor Who magazine. And Paul was like, "Oh, brilliant, that's cool." So we went for a drink after his little talk, and I sort of said, so how do I get paid for this? And he went, "You have to send an invoice off." And I went, "What's an invoice?"
So my first ever invoice was because Paul Cornell told me how to write an invoice. And then I wrote an invoice, got 40 whole pounds from Marvel UK. So my first ever check, I've still got a photocopy of it somewhere with the Hulk on one side and Spider-Man on the other. But then weirdly, my story never actually got printed because actually there was continuity problems with it. So I got paid, which is probably, I got paid and I was like, brilliant, the important part. But then it never got
that printed. That is the important part.
So I've told that story before and Paul does not remember it at all. But that is kind of my Paul Cornell and Gary Russell story. And now I know Paul a little bit from going to conventions in the UK and in the States. And Gary Russell obviously writes for us at Cutaway. And so I'm getting to know him quite well. So he's my editor and I'm his editor. On his Inferno comic, I'm technically the editor, although he doesn't really need any editing. And then on the big Philip Hinchcliffe book that Cutaway are doing, I've written one of the essays for that. And so Gary's the overall editor on that thing. So it's weird how this Doctor Who, as most people listening to this podcast probably can attest, is just running through our lives. Even when there's been years when it hasn't been a big part of my life, it's always there. Even when I was like some scruffy 19-year-old with dreadlocks smoking doobies, I still sent the odd thing off to Doctor Who, and none of my friends knew about it. And I still got £40 and had no one to really tell. It was still like this little weird seam, and now it's taken over my life again. Now I'm in my now I've just entered my 50s. I'm like, actually, that's fine. And then I became a film journalist, I think, because I could never write in for long periods when I was younger. So I think journalism suited me for a long time, but I always
prefer shorter stuff.
I always wanted to be a screenwriter. I always wanted to write comics. Well, that's another thing with comics. I'm from Northampton, which comic fans might know as the home of Alan Moore. And so I did my dissertation on Alan and interviewed him in another very surreal afternoon. I was 20 and I met Alan Moore and went to his house and this is how generous he was to a student. Let me in. We sat there for maybe 8 hours.
Got
absolutely wrecked on jazz cigarettes. Absolutely wrecked. Like, you know, it was just crazy. But the weirdest thing about it, I was interviewing him about everything. And so I had all these tapes for my dissertation and this massive big interview, which I then later sold. That was one of my first, apart from the thing from Gary Russell, that was my first paid work that also got published, was an Alan Moore interview. But then the phone rang and Alan says, could you go and get the phone? So I went and got the phone and the answer was some American guy. And I went, he said, is Alan there? And I was like, he is. Who's calling? And he said, it's Terry Gilliam. So I was like, what?
adding even more to the surreal.
So I was there in this room with Alan Moore with his beard, couldn't see for the smoke, and I'm on the phone to Terry Gilliam. It was a very weird day. And I later got to tell Terry Gilliam that story when I had dinner with him many years later at a film festival. I ran a Q&A with him many, many years later, and he was like, oh yeah, that was when we were trying to get the Watchmen film together, and Terry was, trying to adapt it. And Alan just kept laughing at him, saying, yeah, brilliant, brilliant. It will never work. And I remember Alan telling me a story about how he was there when they were drunk and Terry Gilliam's car got, got towed. Because they'd parked somewhere stupid, and he was just raging in the street, drunk, because his car had been towed. But anyway, and then as years have gone by, I've written for stuff. Screen hasn't turned into. I've got short films. I haven't actually got TV credits yet, but I've been paid to write TV. It's in development. In one of those ways, so many more scripts get written and get made. And then I also write a lot of audio drama. And my latest thing that's sort of in the works, almost finished, is a horror thing. Have you heard of Ramsey Campbell, the novelist? He's like our Stephen King. I've adapted one of his novels, one of his early novels called The Hungry Moon, which weirdly I picked off the shelf because it had an Alan Moore quote on the back saying this was a bad, this was a perfect bad dream of a book. Sort of very Alan Moore thing to say, and a perfect description of it's kind of British Stephen King, so Lovecraftian horror. So I've done that as a 4-hour audio drama, which is almost finished being edited. But for interest with Doctor Who fans, because of all our contacts, it's got Louise Jameson in it, Peter Davison and Colin Baker, and Amina Anwar, who was the Rani's mum in Seven Adventures. So that's got a sort of Doctor Who thing. And then my other thing I'm doing is a thing called Scuttled, which stars somebody called Christopher Eccleston, who I've just recorded in London just before I went to LA, actually. So wasn't intending it to be a Doctor Who thing, but it was very much actually, it was absolutely perfect, and we always had him in mind. The people that I'd written it for aren't Doctor Who people, so I was a bit like, it's going to be a Doctor Who thing. But the main thing I was told was, don't mention Doctor Who to Chris, because if he thinks you've got him in, I mean, he was absolutely lovely and professional, and I did end up talking about Doctor Who with him at the end, but his agent just, maybe don't mention the Doctor Who thing, because I've written
don't start off that way
as well. So yeah, if he thinks I've hired him just to get in the room with a doctor, that might look a bit weird. Just better safe than sorry. But yeah, as it was, he was absolutely lovely and professional, and as you'd expect, and just come back from working with Jodie Foster, so it's like weird, the life of an actor. You work with Jodie Foster, and then you come back and you work with Ian Winterton, you've never heard of. But it's and that's basically me. So now I write for a living, and occasionally teach screenwriting in universities to fill those gaps, and also write for Cutaway, which I'm absolutely loving. And I kind of owe all that side of things to Gareth. So that's good.
Sure. So I'm assuming that you've been, as well as a longtime Doctor Who fan, you've been a longtime comic book reader, and
I did my dissertation on Alan. But weirdly, I love the medium of comics, but I am I think maybe a bit like Gareth. Comics to me are the Doctor Who comic, Absalom Dac and all that sort of era.
Sure.
And 2000 AD, Judge Dredd and Strontium Dog. And I was never massively into superheroes. So the American side of things. So it's a bit like, to me, people assuming you like superheroes because you like comics is a bit like someone assuming you like Westerns because you like movies. It's, you know, I do obviously like some superheroes, but again, I got into them because of Alan Moore. So so it was Watchmen. It was his brilliant run on Swamp Thing, you know. So that's kind of, but I didn't grow up with them in my bones, like, you know, the Marvel DC.
Universe.
Some people can go on about at length, like we can go on about Doctor Who at length, the ins and outs and the canon and the 60 years of lore. I'm completely lost with it, but you know, but I do love comics, but things like the Trigen Empire, I'm just looking around my bookshelf, the Trigen Empire, all the Doctor Who comics. I mean, for me, Doctor Who, when it went away, was the sort of McGann stories that were in Doctor Who magazine. That was, I didn't really read the novel for some reason. But I kept up with like, the Flood and all that sort of stuff. Again, a lot of that written by Martin Geraghty, who we now work with. Cutaway. So my first thing for Cutaway was with Martin Geraghty, which was a bit of a trip.
I'm sure.
Pretty cool. Yeah. And he's absolutely lovely, lovely man as well. Our first Gallifrey, we took him and Stephen Gallagher to LA as our sort of guests, which was just absolutely brilliant. Having the two of them there, getting to know Stephen Gallagher as well, has been an honour. Through Cutaway, because I always loved Warrior's Gate more and more as I got older as well, because it's mystified me when I was a child. And every time I watch it, I like it a bit more.
I'm assuming you got involved with working with Cutaway from Gareth, like you said. Did you and Gareth kind of touch base it through via Doctor Who, or how did you meet Gareth?
Well, he used to run a pub in called the Lasagari. It's still called the Lasagari now, but he doesn't run it anymore. He got out of the business, okay. Or it got out of him. But I first went there through Fringe Theatre when I was writing plays, and then Gareth used to have this room that he used to sort of let people rehearse in or even perform in, and wouldn't charge them. He'd just see it as a way of getting people in the door, just a really lovely atmosphere. But one of the first things I noticed was it was called the Salmon Room because it was full of Adrian Salmon artwork.
Oh, okay.
And then downstairs was the Snug, and it was called the Skin Snug after Des Skin. And so it didn't take very long for me and Gareth to spot fellow travellers. And that kind of coincided with Gareth also putting on his own sort of pub cons. So we'd have he'd be having lots of mini conventions in the pub as another way to bring in, sell lots of beer, basically. So just lots of fan events. And then we did plays together as well. He sort of financed plays, basically justifying them. It was because it was fun, but justifying them because it also brought customers in. So it was a beautiful few years of just writing loads, adapting loads. And, from a comic book point of view, we adapted Halo Jones, another Alan Moore thing. But doing that in a pub was kind of mad. But it worked absolutely back to the rafters. Wow. And I always laugh because we'll sort of joke that Joel, we had better on this. I've better contacts on this and this only than Joel Silver, because Joel Silver, the big angry producer, but he did V for Vendetta, and Alan Moore was furious with him because he tried to, even though Alan refuses to have his name in any of his adaptations, Joel Silver still went and mentioned him at a press conference and caused Alan to have more outrage. But the one thing Alan was quite happy. He said, you don't need my permission. I don't really own Halo Jones, but it's nice to be asked. And allowed his name to be on the poster, which is more than you can say for his Hollywood projects. So that's cool. But I actually met Joel Silver when I was interviewing him as a film journalist. And so I was there with David Lloyd and Joel Silver for part of the V for Vendetta junket. And when I mentioned I knew Alan, the atmosphere went severely frosty. like who let him in? There's a spy kind of thing. David Lloyd. I know people that know him, and he's obviously a lovely man, but that's the only time I've ever met him. But he looked a little bit like, oh God, what's going to happen?
With you knowing Gareth, then I'm assuming that when he came up, or when him and Colin were doing like Vort magazine, you were kind of in the know about that.
I kind of was. I've never done anything on Vort. It's always been up and running, and I haven't done anything on it right up until this latest issue. When I did the script for the Meeting on the Common DVD that comes free with it, which have you seen?
I have seen. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that was an absolute honor to do. I was so proud to do that. That was such a lovely project to be part of, to sort of engage with that David Whittaker novel and then adapt it. And it was actually quite difficult to adapt that for opening chapter because. God bless David Whittaker, but he was writing that very, very quickly at the time in a period where he didn't have any idea that anyone beyond a few kids were probably going to read this, picked over for 60 years as this seminal text. But it's got it's oozing atmosphere and it's brilliantly written. But when you actually break it down and try and go, right, this is especially the Barbara character, and you get Barbara and you go, what does Barbara knows? And you've got to break it down for an actor. It's like, well, she contradicts herself constantly. So I had to basically pick a reality because there's some periods where she talks about, oh, I've met Susan's grandfather, he's a strange old boot. And then later on, I don't know who this, and then she doesn't twig who maybe the old man is. And it's yeah. and it comes and goes. It's basically we're reading a very good first draft.
Yeah.
No one's bothered editing because it's a kid's book in 1964. So it wasn't as straightforward as somebody might think of just getting it. This is what happens. But it's a crazy old thing. I mean, the smoking and the car crash and the blood, the fact you meet Barbara with a half broken arm and a cut face, and Susan we hear is like lying in the road unconscious, and it's just a brilliantly dark, and that they were the main things I wanted to keep in as well. The grumpy doctor and the smoking, all the things that are actually incongruous to Doctor Who as mm-hmm. we just to sort of lean into those, because the book's full of them. And also the fact that Ian and Barbara don't know each other, and Ian's a rocket scientist for some reason.
Yeah.
and the chip on his shoulder, which comes straight from David Whittaker. Nepotism. I haven't got the job because of nepotism. Because he was, from what I know of him, having read Simon Guerrier's brilliant book on Whittaker, he was someone else we got to be on panels with at Gallifrey. But yeah, just that sort of, he had a sense of injustice. He was quite left-leaning, to the point where he almost got blacklisted because he was a bit too pro... Well, he was accused of being a bit pro-Soviet. But he kind of got stuck in this sort of... The Writers Guild didn't... it's quite a complicated story, but he basically went to Russia, gave a talk, and then he kind of gave in to the Soviets' sort of censorship and decided not to criticize them and everyone... for some suppression of some other writers, so he wasn't in solidarity with them, and that kind of led to him getting a little bit blacklisted by the left in the UK, but for him being too pro-Soviet, but not you know, it's a complicated business. But yeah, that sort of, he ended up in the middle between the communists and the socialists, getting blacklisted by his mates back home, kind of thing. But anyway. That's a massive digression, but yeah, just but for people who haven't seen Meeting on the Common, the bit that's nothing to do with me, which is the amazing animation from animator director Mel Meanley, is just god, he's so good. Yeah. And he's 17. I don't know if Gareth's been on and talked about that, hasn't he? But he was like 17, 18, and we couldn't start the project till he finished his A levels, which is like the exams you do to leave high school. Uh-huh. And now he's taking a year off before university to do animation projects, and it's almost like animation with a little bit of the punk ethos, because he just was like, does it in his room on secondhand equipment, bought his mocap suit off eBay, and just does it in his bedroom at his parents' house, and it's amazing.
It turns out he's brilliant.
Yeah, he's got a bright future ahead of him. Absolutely brilliant. But yeah, so that kind of as well as Warp Warp, I've got basically never-ending cutaway comics coming down the track.
Yeah, exactly. So when Gareth came up with the idea for cutaway comics, were you kind of in on the ground floor and say, "Hey, I went in on this"?
I was so on the ground floor that Gareth's been sort of suggesting these sort of things over and over again. And the thing with Gareth, he isn't one of those people that just talks and nothing ever happens, but he's got so many things going on that he suggests so many things, you're never quite sure which of them are going to start taking off. And then he was like, oh, I've met Eric Saywood, so this comic's happening, which turned out to be lit. And I was like, oh, that's cool. But then there were other ideas he had for other IPs. He's always very good, and he's developed this brilliant skill through the years of doing Warp Warp, of getting hold of artists, getting hold of stuff, and then also finding out what IP isn't owned by the BBC. So he's got a massive bunch of contacts, and that brought us into contact with, you already knew Bob Baker and Paul Tams and people from years ago. And again, from running cons and stuff, as well as everything else. But yeah, so when Litton was happening, I was like, oh, that's actually happening. That's cool. And then he was thinking, oh, what if we get this IP? What if we get that IP? And I was like, well, that all sounds good. Everyone's busy. Yeah. Then the pandemic hit. And suddenly it was like, well, it just this little thing that was a side hustle for Gareth suddenly became about five of us. It became our five or six of us. It became our main deal. So it's like, so lots of Zoom, lots of what IP can you get? Oh, suddenly you can get lots of IP. And all the little ideas he'd had, suddenly he just focused straight on them. And he was like, oh, I can get this one. We've got Litton, we've got Omega, we've got Eden, we've got anything Bob Baker's done, because he owns all of it. And wouldn't sell it to the BBC, because by all accounts, he was really pissed off about Arc of Infinity, which they made without his permission. They didn't even think to ask him about Omega. Yeah. It was only when he phoned them up and they went, oh, yeah, sorry, we'll send you a check. And you're like, well, great, but that's not really the point. So he apparently considers the stuff we've written to be more canon to his writing than Arc of Infinity, which he doesn't consider official because he didn't write it or have any hand in it. So that's a nice little thing. And then obviously Stephen Gallagher, because he's quite local to us as well. So Gareth knew of him through cons, and that's been brilliant, as I said, because he wanted to write his own comic. It's the last medium he hadn't done. So his Tharyl comic is absolutely brilliant. And I now have the honor of carrying on with those characters in the sort of Gods and Monsters saga. I'm getting to write Omega, Tharyls. I've got my two Drax one-shots that are coming out. And then Drax is sort of our Doctor figure moving forward.
Sure.
But obviously a very different character from the Doctor, and I'm really, really proud and pleased with the way Bob, before he died, signed off all the storylines and the approaches I'd taken and approved of them at all. And it's not just one of those people that just waves a hand and goes, give me the check. He really was. If he didn't like something, then he'd say, actually, no, I don't think you should do that, or don't do that because it's a bit like this thing I'm doing. So there were a few things like that. But so everything, so it wasn't just like he just gave us an easy ride because we were buying his IP. He really was involved right up until he had his accident. So I can't wait for people to see those. Drax is just being drawn at the moment by Stephen B. Scott, who did the Eldrad Must Live comic, which you've probably already seen, which was turned out to be Bob Baker's last ever professional writing credit. Which is very strange, and sad, but he's writing Drax. He's drawing Drax, which I sort of have him going back. Well, I start with him leaving Brixton Prison, because he talks about having been in Brixton Prison. I used to live very near there, so I know that manor well. So I've got him going back, sort of. Kind of guilt tripped after Armageddon Factor that he actually left a companion behind. Obviously I've invented. So a human friend of his, actually he then just let, so I've got him feeling a bit guilty that actually he did just go off without keeping his promise to her to take her around the universe. So it's almost like I've kind of got him trying to be a bit like the Doctor, having a chip on his shoulder that he's never going to be the Doctor because he's terrible at things. So I really like the character we've created. With him, sort of wheeler dealer trying to do good, but he's still Drax, but he's Drax affected by the Doctor, having met the Doctor without us naming the Doctor. So I'm really pleased with that and excited with that. I'm excited for people to see that Drax. And then in the second one he goes to Los Angeles, inspired very much by the fact that me and Gareth went to Santa Monica during our first time going to we basically go there before every Gallifrey now. We go to Santa Monica for a day. So we're going to have that sort of 1970, whatever it is, in Santa Monica. So we're going to have Muscle Beach. We're going to have little unofficial cameos for Arnold Schwarzenegger down on Muscle Beach. There's a sort of little thing because we have the main villain in that as a cyborg. So we've got sort of little nods to thing Arnold will become famous for. and little stuff like that. But so I'm basically, a lot of this I've already written, but with comics it's a slow old medium to get going. It's really fun when they get printed because you're like, it's almost like someone else has written it. It's like, oh, this is good.
I was gonna ask you when you got involved with Cutaway and beginning to take a stab at writing comics, having a background more in doing interviews and magazine articles and things like that, how much of a learning curve was it for you to learn how to write a comic script compared to just doing like long form stuff?
I guess it wasn't. I don't think it was too much of a learning curve for me at all, partly because I wasn't just a journalist. I'd already written lots of scripts for, mm-hmm. you know, for screen and audio. Sure. Okay. And weirdly, even though I'd never had any comics published, I'd written a lot of them, like in my earlier days, especially. And like I say, my dissertation on Alan Moore, I basically studied the art form, like, and got a really good mark for my dissertation. Okay. So I kind of knew how comics worked. So I just kind of wrote them and they just seem, I mean, other people will have to judge, but I think I have an understanding of the medium that just means I've just gone in there. And then once you understand the medium, all the stories are story is story. It doesn't really matter what the medium is. You're still using, you know, I teach structure and I teach all that screenwriting stuff. But it all works in every single story medium. So it's just once you know, so I think I could say I've quite naturally fallen into writing comics because in a weird way, that's what I wanted to do when I was 15. And maybe I should have done back then. But, so it's very natural that I'm writing comics and I hope I get to do some bigger ones as well. And maybe even stuff that's got nothing to do with Doctor Who as well. So it's a medium I've always loved, and I'm kind of rediscovering how much I love it over the past 5 or 6 years.
That's awesome. One of the other questions I had for you is, you had said before that you tried writing like novels and more lengthy stories, and you found that you enjoyed writing, being more of a journalist, for writing short, you know, articles and stuff like that was more along your liking. Is writing a comic book kind of along that way too, because you're basically trying to tell a story or part of a story in a short time span, or number of pages?
No, I think writing comics is definitely still in the part of my brain that, you know, is like writing scripts and things. I think what it was when I was younger, I think maybe I was the sort of person that I wasn't. I think you have to have a certain ability to sit down for long periods of time to write long form anything. Yeah. And I think when I was younger, I just wasn't that. I wanted to do that, but every time I did, I didn't do it. So, but when it came to journalism, it's like sit down, do something. And then it was a lot more, it kind of suited me when I was younger for 20 years, I guess. And then eventually it's almost like I've come back to myself, because I used to sit as a child before adolescence writing for hours and hours and hours. So it's like I've come back to myself, and now I'm able to sit and really enjoy, and I don't feel like I'm missing anything. Whereas when I was 20s and 30s, I was like, having a very social life that, you know,
yeah,
basically interviewing lots of Hollywood stars and running around and going to parties and occasionally writing an article really quickly and firing it off and then running around to do the next thing. And, you know, So I think it's taken a long time for me to sort of come back to the sort of thing I've done bits of all my life. Like, I have written short films, and I have written, you know, I have written for Black Library short stories and stuff, you know, like the Warhammer stuff. Yeah. So, you know, so over the years I have done these bits and bats, but it's only now I'm able to, I think, have the, I don't know, the maturity, or maybe I'm just old, I'm able to sit without freaking out, I'm missing something. But but it, you know, things come at a certain time, because some people who were able to get the writing bug in their 20s, they've, you know, not all of them, some of them are like Paul Cornell, who's still going, but others kind of burnt out and they were able to do stuff, but they don't do it anymore because they've moved on to other things. And
you're almost kind of the opposite, where you kind of let it simmer in the background for you until the time is right, where you feel like now is the time for me to start telling the stories I want to tell.
Yeah, well, I keep saying it's like, well, coming up with ideas really isn't a problem, because I think I've been running a subroutine for the past 40 years in my little brain. And so it's full of Doctor Who stories that I'm going, oh, that'd be a good Doctor Who story. One day I should write a Doctor Who story. And now I'm actually doing them as like, I've got loads of stories. So, you know, and now I've got to write for Big Finish as well, which I've been wanting to do for 20 odd years as well. So, you know, I've recorded my first Big Finish just at the end of last year. It won't be out till 2025, but that's the nature of Big Finish. So I can't tell you what it is. But so hopefully I'm doing some more of that as well. So yeah, so it's just like, yeah, just weirdly, this thing with Gareth and embracing my Doctor Who fan side instead of maybe I was a little bit back to the sort of Paul Cornell story right at the beginning. Because one thing he said was, oh, you know, he's like, oh, you should come to conventions because then you'll meet the people and you maybe could start writing for the things. And that's how I started writing for Judge Dredd as well as everything, because I went to a convention. I was like, oh, that sounds good. I went, well, yeah, so come to a convention. And I said, nah, I don't really like the idea of dressing up. It's a bit silly. So, so the cool me who was like 19, 20, had too much cultural cringe to go to a Doctor Who convention. Idiot. But now I go, hey, I'm going to a Doctor Who convention. But, you know. But, yeah. So it's, I think maybe you spend too much of your 20s trying to be cool and denying your true self.
Maybe. I can definitely see that.
Yeah.
So what was it like having your first comic work come out as an actual comic and to hold it in your hands and go, look, this is what me and, you know, an artist created?
It was brilliant, and it's weird. I don't know if everyone does this, but just the amount of times I've read that comic that I wrote, it's like, oh, reading it again. But but it's good as well, because I've got three kids as well, so it's cool to go, here's this comic, and actually it's something they can read as well. Because, you know, you write something for audio, and, you know, your modern child doesn't listen to audio. They're like, what? I'm not listening to anything audio. It's not aimed at them, but this is a comic. And they kind of know what Doctor Who is. And my youngest one really loves Doctor Who, and the other two older ones don't like it that much, but they know what it is. So, so it's kind of cool having kids and going, here's a comic, and, you know, giving them a copy. And so, yeah, so it is a little buzz. But maybe it's all that bit sweeter because I didn't get around to doing it when I was younger. Various reasons. I did have a thing.
But, I think anybody who works at, or who creates the comic, whether it's the writer writing the story or the artist that draws it, their first one they do is always something that they treasure, and they go, you know, look what I accomplished, look what I did.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, one of the biggest buzzers, because obviously the first thing I wrote was the sort of backup strip, Demons of Eden. But the real buzz of that was when it got reprinted, edited by Des Skin, and it got reprinted as the sort of black and white 1979 version. So all in one thing, and that was the biggest buzz, because it's like Des Skin, who shaped my childhood, is now editing me. That was absolutely brilliant. So I don't know if you've seen that copy, but
I have not. I don't know.
No, it's just all four issues. So how many pages? So it's a 20-page story, but it also has. Des has sort of reshaped it, made it black and white because it was colorized in the original printing. And then he's also and it looks brilliant because it looks like the same typeface as they had in 1979 in Doctor Who magazine.
Okay.
So it has articles on Demons of Eden, and it has weird little competitions, and it has a fake letters page, it's a fake letters page. It's from real people, so it has Matthew Waterhouse and Paul Cornell and a photo of Russell T. Davis with a mandrel, a friend of ours, a friend of ours built this brilliant mandrel mask and just has this brilliant photo of Russell T. Davis holding his mandrel in the face. So it's a lovely little sort of collectible thing. It sells really well when we have our tables in the UK, but I don't know how much amongst Doctor Who fandom in general, Doctor Who magazine doesn't seem to be as much a part of their childhood as for most of them. So nostalgia hit didn't seem to translate to most Americans. But I'm guessing you, with your being very much the comic book guy.
I'm sure I would appreciate it. And catch all that.
We'll have to send you the digital of it. And
That'd be great. That'd be awesome.
I'll get Gareth to do that.
Awesome. So with the Big Gods and Monsters crossover story that's going on, how difficult has it been for you to work on this as far as like come up with a story involving all these different properties?
It's been actually pretty difficult, and to the point where I've even said to Gareth, you've scored too many IP. Let's take some and save them. So I'm a bit like, it's getting too crowded. It's getting a bit, I mean, we're kind of leaning into the fact it's basically our version of the the cinematic universe.
The cinematic universe.
The MCU. And because we have these standalone stories, and then it's going to be like the six issue, although it'd be three prestige issues now, I think.
Yeah.
That has all different characters in it, but Drax and the Tharal princess that Steven invented are going to be the two main characters, but also with Omega and Sutek in there. And Eldrad's kind of part of the thread of that, but that's one of the first things I've done. Do you know what? We've had a lot of Eldrad. Let's park Eldrad.
Because
my first Drax standalone, the thing he gets into, so he gets into the aftermath of Eldrad Must Live. So that Drax is a sequel to Bob Baker's sequel to The Hand of Fear.
Okay.
So, and when you say it like that, it's like, actually, that's enough Eldrad. So Eldrad, full stop. Okay. Although what happens in that issue, because it's quite timey-wimey in a nice way, because I've leaned into the fact, one of the things Drax says in the Armageddon Factor is he's terrible at temporal mechanics, or whatever the line is. So he tries to do something clever, like maybe the Doctor would, and it really doesn't go quite right. So that's kind of part of it. So Eldrad's not in the final thing, but I won't spoil it. But what happens while Drax is dealing with Eldrad does play throughout the whole thing. But it's I'm really pleased with the storyline, and it's quite timey-wimey, but it's also quite epic. I mean, I don't know if Gareth said before, his main sort of impetus was just the image of, I think it's, is it Knights of Infinity? When it's the two big men in sort of armor, and they've got beards, and they kind of look weirdly like Brian Blessed, which weirdly, it's ended up being what our Omega is, because we cast Brian Blessed in the audio adaptation. He liked it so much that he said we could use his likeness. So now our Brian Blessed looks like our Omega is wearing this massive amount of armor, but when you see his head, it's Brian Blessed's head with a beard. Because with Omega, we've decided it's sort of, you know, we never say this is definitely where anything is, because you can't with the way Doctor Who works, but we've kind of, to us, it's basically, obviously, we've seen Omega without a form in the Three Doctors. So we kind of go, well, that's probably the end of his life. We're seeing him not long after he's been imprisoned. So he's still got a body, and he escapes a little bit. But actually, So he's in the first phases of falling apart, which obviously then, however many millions of years later, leads to him being the mad guy that the Three Doctors deal with. I don't know how I got onto that. So the Knights, I think it's the Knights of Infinity anyway, but those two fighting just made Gareth go, well, I want to see Sutek and Omega duking it out on the side of a mountain. That's all he wants. That's basically the only brief I had, was those two are going to have a big fight.
Here's what you got to have.
So that's going to happen. And now I've upped it a bit. So it's the side of a volcano. But how that all fits in with everything else, and Tharals, and time travel, and Drax, and I've even forgotten Iris Wildthyme as well, who I don't know if you know. Do you know Iris Wildthyme? So Paul Mars, who's also lives in Manchester, so Gareth's known him for centuries as well. But he just gave us permission to use Iris Wildthyme, And weirdly, Iris Wildthyme's never been, she's been in audio novels, but she's never been a comic book character before.
Nope, she hasn't.
So Sean Mason has written Iris Wildthyme, the one shot, a friend of ours called Sean.
Okay.
Who also wrote the Paradise Towers stuff for Cutaway, which is absolutely brilliant. But yeah, then I'm carrying, then that's her one shot, but then she's also in the sort of saga. So I've sort of fitted in a bit that she, you know, she knows Drax of old, same as she knows the Doctor of old kind of thing.
True.
So yeah, so it's a very complicated, not that complicated though, but I'm on top of it and it's going to be, yeah, it's going to be wonderful, but Lord knows when it will all be finished, but it's coming. By next Gallifrey, we basically, that's become our Christmas now. When's Gallifrey? Every February. by next Gallifrey, we'll have the Philip Hinchcliffe book, piles of them. Yeah. And we'll have Drax. We'll have two Draxes. We'll have probably Iris Wildthyme because that's finished. And we'll have, what else is there? Another thing that Steve Gallagher has written, which is a character called Losco, which I actually named, but it comes from the fact I sort of said from Steve's novelization of Warrior's Gate. He has this little bit at the beginning where he shows, he calls it the Antonine Killers, and they're the ones that shoot the privateer that sends the privateer off into E-Space because he knackers its engines. So I kind of had the idea of having that as a character, and all he really says is they've got paws. So now with Steve, working with Steve, we've worked out that this Antonine Killer that we called Losco is a sort of cousin species to the Ferals. So that kind of means why they're kind of Black Panthers. So without it going a bit too Thundercats, that was the danger. but so we've got this character as well, who's also tied into it. It's going to be such a lovely saga. When in about 2 years, it's all done. It's going to be, God knows how many hundreds of pages by the time it's finished. Yeah. And it's all plotted.
I'm looking forward to it just because I think it's really interesting having all these properties and characters and stuff that tie in to Doctor Who that we all know, and just seeing how they're going to interact and what kind of a big, vast story this is going to be by the time it's all said and done, involving all these, you know, wonderful characters. It's going to be really something to behold.
Yeah, it's been an absolute honor. It's so much fun. And but dare I say it, it's going to be a bloody good story. It's, it really is. It's going to be a bloody good saga.
On your end of things, as far as writing this, like, you know, the artwork's being done for the kind of the start of the story. How far ahead are you working on this story? Are you going to just kind of working your way through to get the whole story down?
Well, I'm doing it chapter by chapter. So I guess how slow the actual artwork is to come out and get commissioned. And so it's almost inevitable that my script will be finished well before an artist gets hold of it. But we'll see. Suddenly it might all start ramping up. But for instance, I've written my Drax scripts 2 years ago, and they're just they're just being finished now, and the same with the others. And some of that's because of various things happening that meant, you know, things sort of maybe got a little bit delayed. But generally the writing side of comics is much faster than the drawing side.
Right? Yeah, most definitely. You know,
typing away and going, bum, 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 it's finished. But I tell you one thing I've learned is not to write too far in advance because things change, or you get so actually I'm trying to write as close to the artist.
But saying, I'm ready. That's what I was kind of wondering is how far in advance you're able to work with, you know, if as an artist is coming up with the artwork and stuff, and is you know, the whoever is editing whatever book says, oh, we want to change this a little bit, how that would affect or possibly affect something that you have written, you know, a year ago that you have to go, oh, no, now I have to go make a change.
Well, I suppose we've had a few things like that. I mean, the one thing we did have, back to Brian Blessed, is Brian Blessed talking to us about Omega for the audio drama inspired me how it kind of made me go, oh, this is how this is kind of, I don't want to give too much away, but basically it made me go, like, he was just going on about Omega being Satan. And a bit like, you know, and then that immediately made us think of, you know, Milton and Paradise Lost and the Blake, you know, the Blake pictures. And so I was just like, well, our Omega, because he's in a big battle suit, he's got to have wings. So I took Mark Griffiths's, you know, the, you know, absolutely brilliant script, but I went, we've got to change the last four pages.
Yeah.
Just as John Ridgway was sort of approaching drawing those pages. And went, oh, I'm going to change it. So we then now have this double page spread of course I'm a, I have wings. Of course I have wings. Cause I am a god. And, so yeah. So, but that's all inspired by conversation with Brian Blessed and will come into play in the sort of saga when we see Omega again. So he's a sort of, cause our Omega isn't just a straightforward villain. He's a bit more in between. As you will see, he's still out for himself and a murderer, but he's also, when you're facing something like Sutek, maybe he's a little bit on your side as well, just out of necessity. The enemy of my whatever it is, the enemy of my friend is the enemy of my no the friend of my no what is
the
it
enemy,
the enemy of my enemy, enemy is of my
the
friend.
Enemy is my friend.
Yeah. God. I take a lot of getting out of it. It's quite late over here. But yeah. So there's so many cool things. It's been absolutely brilliant.
The past five years of
just diving into all this stuff.
Well, it sounds like it's gonna be just as impressive as I'm expecting it to be, just on the characters that are involved, the people who are working on it, and you know, everything that Cutaway Comics has put out so far has been really impressive. And this is going to be almost kind of like a culmination of all this stuff, you know, coming into this big giant story.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a long time. That's the thing I was forgetting. The thing that did stall things was the invasion of Ukraine, because that, you know, I mean, one of the least important things it's done is really wreck the publishing industry.
Yeah.
And in someone little like Cutaway Comics, it's been really affecting.
Yeah,
the printing industry in general, because we knew how much paper came out of Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, so that's why we're still doing things so long. We would have done them by now. Yeah, because that threw a spanner in the works somewhat.
Yeah,
which is why we're not doing the singles and we're going straight to prestige. And the trades. It's lovely to have our first lot of trades as well. So we've just we've now got Paradise Towers collected as a trade, the Litton collected as a trade, and what's the third one? And then the Omega with the John Ridgway collected as a trade. So, and they were selling really well, because it's just, I don't know about you, but I'm not made of money. So as a comic buyer myself, I quite often wait for trades.
I know, and especially speaking as me over here in the States, I've backed all the Cutaway projects.
Yeah,
since they've started, but I've always backed them as PDF copies.
Yeah,
The cost of shipping to send all that over here to the States costs just as much, if not more, than the stuff themselves. So I've been waiting for the trades to come out, because one, it's more cost effective for me, and two, I like having the books on my bookshelf that when I want to pull them out and read them, I can just pull them out. And, you know,
Well, that's the great thing about the prestige as well, because if they've just got a spine, then they're just that little bit more desirable. So, so everything now, I think I'm right. Cutaway won't be bringing out anything from now on that doesn't have a spine, basically. So, prestige and trade will be the two formats. But but it's been absolutely brilliant. But it's the postage is why it's actually worth Gareth and I coming to LA, because the postage to the US is so exorbitant. And your postal service seems to damage a lot of things as well. So it's actually worth us coming, and it's quite fun as well. It's worth us coming to LA, because so many Doctor Who fans gathered in one place. They all know we're coming. I mean, we're talking about maybe having a little window, a sort of US postage window while we're in the States, saying for this week only, your orders will You know, if you can't be at Gallifrey, but they will at least be sent as though you're in the US. They'll be sent.
Okay. You know, count me in on that. If you not if international, like that would happen. I would definitely take advantage of that.
It didn't quite happen this year just because so many things to organize. But yeah, that was my idea, and Gareth approves of it. Whether we'll next year, you must remind us the little US postage window.
Do that.
Yeah, do that.
Well, Ian, you know, it's been a pleasure getting to I've seen your name numerous times. It's a pleasure that I've had a chance to chat with you and learn about your career and how you got into writing and how you got into work with Cutaway. And I know me and a bunch of other, Doctor Who comic fans and spinoff comic fans are really looking forward to seeing Gods and Monsters and seeing how this all plays out over the next couple of years. So thank you for taking time for this weekend to chat with me, and thank you for listening to my podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's an honor. I love your podcast.
Many thanks to writer Ian Winterton. Like I said, he's one of the featured writers for Cutaway Comics. He has Gods and Monsters coming out here shortly from them, and it was great learning more about him and his work with these Doctor Who spinoff comics. I once again apologize for the sound of the audio on my end. Sometimes you don't learn about the audio quality of stuff until after it's all said and done, but I think you were able to hear me well enough to know what questions I asked, and definitely heard Ian's answers. So thank you, Ian. I appreciate you joining me. Thank you for listening to the podcast, and thank you to all of you out there for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed what you heard, and if you're looking for past episodes, make sure you check your podcast feed for Doctor Who Panel to Panel, and you can see all the previous episodes on your current podcast feed. You can also go to archive.org and do a search for Jeremy B. Ment. That's cement, but with a B, or Doctor Who Panel to Panel, and you can find all previous episodes as easy-to-download MP3 files. So, until next time, this is Jeremy Bement saying thank you for listening, and bye. Doctor Who Panel to Panel, the podcast about Doctor Who comics, thanks you for downloading this episode. Let us know what you thought about this episode or of Doctor Who comics in general. You can find us socially on Facebook at Doctor Who Panel to Panel, on Twitter at Doctor Who P2P, 2 being the number 2, and online at DoctorWhoComics.com. Download previous episodes via your favorite podcast service and find the complete catalog of episodes featuring amazing interviews with creators past and present at archive.org. Just search for Doctor Who Panel to Panel. Thank you.